Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who reflects on the 71st anniversary of the atomic bombs dropped by the U.S. on Japan in 1945, as America is poised to spend $1 trillion building a new generation of nuclear weapons. Longtime civil rights activist Bob Zellner, who talks about his work today with the Moral Mondays movement, which launched their Moral Revolution of Values tour across the U.S. in April. And 9/11 widow and activist Kristen Breitweiser, who discusses new information found in the recently declassified 28 pages of the Congressional September 11th inquiry, highlighting the links between the Saudi Arabian government and 9/11 hijackers. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the Olympic torch passed through the poor suburbs of Rio de Janeiro, police fired stun grenades and tear gas against protesters angry at the enormous cost of the Olympic Games. On full display were the same heavy-handed tactics used by security forces in Rio State that led to police killing 645 people in 2015. Thus far in 2016, over 300 have been killed by police in Greater Rio. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have long considered the Rio police among the most violent in the world, with charges that they often engage in extrajudicial executions. According to the Guardian newspaper, reform of the police department was undertaken during Brazil's boom times, which reduced the level of police violence by 60%, particularly in the impoverished favela neighborhoods. Yet police killings are now on the rise again in the wake of Brazil's current economic crisis and the effort to rein in drug gangs during the earlier 2014 World Cup and the current Olympic Games. A recent statement by Amnesty International reported a 103% spike in police killings in Rio over the last year. Brazil's Amnesty Director, Attila Roque, declared, "The seemingly unstoppable rise in killings by the police has hurt any chance of a positive Olympic legacy in the area of public safety." 30 years after scientists warned of a growing ozone hole in the Earth's atmosphere, there are signs the ozone layer is starting to recover. In 1987, global heads of state signed the Montreal Protocol, which phased out the production and use of ozone-destroying chemicals known as CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons, which had been used as a coolant. Optimism about the restoration of the ozone hole over Antarctica comes from new data released in late June showing the gap in the ozone layer had shrunk 1.5 million square miles since the year 2000. But progress is still fragile, noted lead researcher Susan Solomon of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She told the Christian Science Monitor that last year scientists observed the largest ozone hole ever. However, researchers soon realized the increase in the ozone hole was aggravated by the eruption of the Andean volcano Calbuco. Stratospheric ozone filters out most of the sun's potentially harmful shortwave ultraviolet radiation. When ozone is depleted, more UV rays reach the Earth. Exposure to high amounts of UV rays have serious impacts on human beings, animals, and plants, including more skin cancers, eye cataracts, and the weakening of the human immune system. 15 years ago, the Radical Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, began organizing fast food workers at chains like Starbucks and Jimmy John's. At the time, mainstream labor leaders were baffled, given the high turnover of fast food workers, which made it extremely difficult to successfully organize these low-wage workers. Now, the movement for a $15 minimum wage is being led by fast food workers with support from major labor unions and politicians like Bernie Sanders and California Governor Jerry Brown. The IWW is now moving into its next cause, pushing the labor movement to rally behind the 400,000 Americans toiling behind bars in prison labor. This week, the IWW and affiliated groups organized prison labor strikes in states including Alabama, Texas, Missouri, and Ohio. The union has called for a national strike on September the 9th to mark the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising. According to the online Payday report, labour advocates assert inmates have the right to organise under the jurisdiction of the National Labour Relations Board to negotiate over issues like wages and work hours. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The people of Japan solemnly gathered again this year on August 6th and 9th to mark the death and destruction wrought by the U.S. dropping of atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 that effectively ended World War II. This first, second, and only use of nuclear weapons in war killed an estimated 140,000 people in Hiroshima and 70,000 in the port city of Nagasaki. While President Barack Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima on May 27th, the first by a sitting U.S. president, was a gesture appreciated by many in Japan, recent comments by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump about nuclear weapons has caused distress and anxiety. The GOP candidate, known for his off-the-cuff remarks and a constant stream of factually inaccurate statements, suggested in March that Japan and South Korea should develop their own nuclear arsenal. He also asked why U.S. military commanders haven't used nuclear weapons since 1945, while refusing to rule out an American nuclear attack in Europe. As Americans prepare to choose their next president in November, the Obama administration and Pentagon plan to spend $1 trillion to modernize America's nuclear arsenal, including aircraft and submarines, over the next three decades has emerged as an important issue. Prominent scholars and activists have called on Mr. Obama in recent months to make good on his 2009 pledge in Prague to move the world toward nuclear disarmament during his remaining months in office. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, political and communications director with Peace Action, who was reached in Japan, where he was attending ceremonies commemorating the 1945 atomic bomb attack. Here, Martin discusses the steps that could be taken by the president to reduce the likelihood that nuclear weapons will ever be used again.
There's a little bit of disbelief here, especially on the heels of our current President Obama, who, you know, within the first year of his presidency, was the first president to say he wanted to see a world free of nuclear weapons, and ended up taking some minor steps in that direction, including negotiating of the New START treaty, which cut our nuclear arsenals by 10% with Russia, some nuclear security summits, several of those that he put together to secure nuclear materials, and even changing a little bit of the language that we would never use nuclear weapons on a non-nuclear state. And then lastly, his visit to Hiroshima, which was historic, that happened a couple of months ago. So when they're looking at a next president, one who seems to throw around "let's nuke them" or "nuke him," you know, just like it's a slap in the face and not taking nuclear weapons seriously, and nuclear weapons in which scientists say if several were used at once could actually end humanity as we know it because of something called nuclear winter. The dust created from several nuclear weapons could block out the sun and actually change or end human life as we know it. To joke around and use it so freely, and clearly not to understand that there was another report where Trump kept saying, "Why can't we just use nuclear weapons? Why can't we just use nuclear weapons?" So clearly a misunderstanding of the power of nuclear weapons and why we should never use it again. You can contrast that to Hillary Clinton, who was head of the State Department, Secretary of State, during the time in which we negotiated the New START treaty with Russia. So that's clearly a positive thing. She hasn't come out as strongly as President Obama in her language, in which she says in some century we should get rid of these weapons altogether. But nonetheless, it seems like she has a better understanding on the power and destruction of these weapons that really should never be used again.
Paul, as we mark the 71st anniversary of the dropping of the U.S. nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, President Obama sits in office And despite his earlier pledges to work towards nuclear disarmament in the world, it looks like the United States is on track to spend $1 trillion over the next 3 decades modernizing the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. There is growing opposition to this idea of spending this enormous amount of money, and of course, the concern about the destabilizing effect of a whole new generation of nuclear weapons in the United States and what that would trigger in other countries.
Yes, so the president has made some minor steps forward, as I mentioned before, with the START Treaty, but as he has reduced the number of nuclear weapons the least of any post-Cold War president. So he certainly has a long several steps to go, I think, to live up to his speech that he made in Prague about ridding the world of nuclear weapons, and his Nobel Peace Prize, which, for the most part, was given because of his pledge against nuclear weapons and his pledge to remove troops out of Iraq. So one of the things that he did, and our understanding is actually regretful and doesn't think it's actually been interpreted quite the way he thought, is part of the way he got the START Treaty passed through the Senate, which needed to be ratified, was an agreement to keep funding of some of the nuclear weapons systems. But the current funding, as you mentioned, to upgrade all of our warheads and the delivery systems, so that's bombers, missiles, and submarines, is going to cost $1 trillion over the next 30 years. And that's really something we can't afford. I mean, there's people even in the Defense Department and government, this is a bipartisan issue in which they're looking at these costs at a time where we're supposedly moving towards less nuclear weapons and we're going to spend all this money to refurbish the systems. It just doesn't make sense. And as you mentioned, some of these weapons can be very destabilizing. So one of the ones that's been put forth is something called the long-range standoff missile, which is basically a new nuclear cruise missile. This cruise missile, if it was launched at someone, you would not be able to tell if it's a nuclear cruise missile or a regular cruise missile. So if we end up putting this weapon together, then any country who sees a cruise missile coming from anywhere couldn't assume that it's not a nuclear weapon, and it could cause an accidental nuclear war. It also, as you mentioned, could cause buildup, specifically in China, maybe North Korea, and in other countries. So we're hoping in the next 5 months of the president's term that we will see a couple of steps in that direction. Some that are being pushed are something called a no first use policy, which will say we would never use nuclear weapons first. We have several thousand weapons in reserve, and we could say that we are going to dismantle a certain portion of those. We could move from our 1,500 strategic warheads and say we're going to unilaterally move down to 1,000, which the Department of Defense says we could easily do. And there's a number of other steps that we could do to move the ball forward and try to keep our pledge in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says that we will be moving towards disarmament.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Political and Communications Director with Peace Action. Learn more about the steps President Obama could take to move toward nuclear disarmament by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, is a nationally known human rights leader. At the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, he endorsed Hillary Clinton and explained why he was troubled by the way faith is cynically used by some to serve hate, fear, racism, and greed. Barber is now on a revival tour, speaking in some 20 states, preaching the gospel of a moral revolution of values in response to racism, sexism, economic inequality, and attacks on the LGBT community. One member of Reverend Barber's revival team is Bob Zellner, who was the first white Southerner to become a community organizer with one of the most important civil rights groups of the 1960s, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Zellner, the grandson and son of members of the Ku Klux Klan, began his activism as a freedom writer in 1961 as SNCC's field secretary. He traveled from Atlanta to Albany, Georgia, to test 2 U.S. Supreme Court decisions that outlawed the segregation of interstate travel facilities and was arrested 18 times in 7 states. Many SNCC organizers risked their lives traveling to the most dangerous areas of the South to help black citizens register to vote. Bob Zellner, now 76, currently works with the North Carolina NAACP, where he trains activists in the SNCC form of community organizing. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Zellner about what he sees as today's key human rights struggles and how they can be won.
As one who did fight 50 years ago in the South to end a kind of deliberate violence, state-sponsored violence, and it was supported by a lot of vigilante action as well. And we're faced today with the same situation. In the 50s, we were working in the worst parts of the United States to try to do away with the terror of lynching and castration. And in today, we have a situation now with the wealth having been so severely redirected upward that we have whole classes of people now being oppressed. And the police are needed now more than they have been, say, in the last 20 or 30 years, because there's a lot of unrest. And police are generally used to keep labor strife down and keep people in line. And it's the difficult thing we're faced with now is that reforms, tiny reforms like having prosecutors not prosecute their own police, that would be a very difficult thing to get done. So I think what's on the agenda now is a thoroughgoing moral and a revolution of values in this country, the kind that Dr. King was talking about in the Poor People's Campaign 50 years ago. We're rejuvenating that campaign now with Reverend Barber and the people at Union Theological Seminary in New York to try to get people together across class lines, across race lines, obliterate all these lines between people so we can get people power back. We've given up a lot of our democracy.
Bob Zellner, it sounds like you're articulating mostly a class analysis, but I wonder where race fits in, and particularly what you think of the Black Lives Matter movement, especially with your background in fighting for civil rights over the past 50 years.
Yes, it's specifically related to Black Lives Matter, and the reason that's an important emphasis is that when we have such deeply ingrained racism in this country, Black Lives Matter have to be emphasized because they become so cheap and overlooked that all lives begin not to matter very much. And our slogan now is that all lives won't matter until Black Lives Matter. So it is a specific problem, and race is so at the center of this police violence that we have to pay attention to that especially, because that's basically the motivation for people to give up their rights. And the Trump movement and the Tea Party movement asks white working people to give up their economic well-being in exchange for being racially superior. So the race is used as an economic bludgeon against even the white working class.
That is a really interesting way to put it. It seems to kind of address the whole split between those who say Black Lives Matter and those who insist all lives matter. One last question. During this crazy election season, your movement is supporting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Reverend Barber actually endorsed her when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention. I just wonder if taking sides like that limits your outreach or your effectiveness, and if it might be better to maintain your neutrality.
Well, as NAACP people, we have to be nonpartisan, but as human beings, we know that we're in a struggle now, so that we have to support one or the other of the establishment candidates. We have an establishment candidate and an anti-establishment candidate, and in this case, we have to support the establishment candidate, Hillary, even though we have a lot of disagreements, because the alternative is just like Germany, because if you mobilize the white working class on the basis of their whiteness, it's going to be a white nationalism or white supremacist movement that's gotten us into a fix that we're in already. We have to jettison that and go with a kind of unity organizing. And the election campaign, we see it as a way of organizing, not as an end in itself. And I'm very concerned about people who are ultra-left or ultra-pure, especially in swing states like my state of North Carolina. Well, we have to get out and vote, and we have to vote in this case for the Democratic candidate, because the alternative is going to open up our country to further destruction of the democratic process that we used to have. We're probably under an oligarchy now, but we will definitely be under if this crazy man is able to win.
That was Bob Zellner, former SNCC field secretary, who now works with the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. His memoir, published in 2008, is titled The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement. Learn more about the Moral Mondays movement and Bob Zellner by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After more than 13 years of withholding 28 pages of classified documents that were part of the congressional inquiry into the September 11th al-Qaeda attacks on America that killed 3,000 people in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania, U.S. intelligence officials released those pages on July 15th. Although redactions totaled more than 3 pages of the original 29, the documents feature new details about the alleged links between the 19 September 11th hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabian citizens, and the Saudi government. Analysis of the documents found that 2 of the hijackers were in contact with and received support or assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government. News outlets examining the declassified pages found a link between an alleged al-Qaeda operative and a company associated with a key member of the Saudi royal family, former Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest maintained that the now declassified pages doesn't change the assessment of the U.S. government, that there's no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually funded al-Qaeda. However, activists and members of some 9/11 victims' families continue to demand an independent investigation into links they maintain exist between the Saudi government and the hijackers, the release of additional documents, and accountability for those implicated. Your reporter spoke with Kristen Breitweiser, a September 11th widow and activist working with a group of other 9/11 widows known as the Jersey Girls. Here she reviews new information found in the declassified 28 pages of the Congressional 9/11 inquiry.
What we found out is that, first and foremost, the government was not exactly forthright with the American public. They kept 29 pages secret from us because it was inconvenient, it was embarrassing, and it was an uncomfortable situation because, for a bunch of reasons, the United States wants to continue this unhealthy relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The second thing that you need to realize is that because this information was withheld for so long, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was never held accountable. The 29 pages reveal in very clear detail funding of various hijackers, operational support, financial support of the hijackers. It mentions a Saudi ambassador who provided an enormous amount of support. It mentions a terrorist named Abu Zubaydah, who was captured overseas and who had that particular ambassador's phone number in his pocket. So you see, there were some glaring problems in the 29 pages that showed clearly that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, its officials, and some of its royal family were not our allies. They, in fact, facilitated, in many ways, the 9/11 attacks. So it's frustrating for the 9/11 families to read this information so many years later, to know that the kingdom is still not being held accountable, to know that even President Obama, you know, not exactly being honest with the American public and wants to continue this in what we would consider an unhealthy relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
So, Kristen, CIA Director John Brennan has said there's
really no evidence that the Saudi government was directly involved in the 9/11 attack. And you often hear officials who make that declaration say that there may have been actors, citizens, or people in the monarchy in Saudi Arabia who may have been involved in terrorism, and certainly there's evidence over the years that that's true, but they declare that there's no official government involvement.
I don't really know how much higher you get with government involvement than, you know, the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, or his wife. And furthermore, what you need to understand is that not just the funding of the 9/11 hijackers, but funding of terrorist groups in general through the charities that are directly related to the Saudi government. What you need to understand is charities in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia don't work the way charities work in the U.S. Charities in Saudi Arabia are government charities. It's the government running those charities. And the government knows fully well what they're doing when they're handing over money to groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And those groups are hell-bent on killing Americans. And, you know, you're seeing the results of that this very day around the world when you have ISIS carrying out attacks, whether they're in Belgium, Paris, San Bernardino, Orlando, Nice, wherever. And I personally feel the reason why those attacks are still occurring is because the Saudis have never been held accountable. There's no denying the fact that if you dry up terrorist funding, groups like ISIS can't kill people. You know, they need money to operate. They need money to run their websites. They need money to buy plane tickets to fly to places like Nice and Paris and Belgium. They need money to teach people how to build bombs and have training camps. And when you cut off that funding, when you stop enabling them to preach the hate that they're doing to kill the infidels, you know, the terrorist attacks are going to stop. And it's not a panacea. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it's certainly hitting terrorism at the root. And what boggles my mind is why the U.S. government is so unwilling to hold the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia accountable.
That was Kristen Breitweiser, a September 11th widow and activist. She's the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. Find links to the declassified documents and Kristen's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Heal and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.